current state. Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. If you've begun to make plans to attend the Great Lakes Folk Festival, that is sneaking up on us here. That is not this coming weekend, but the following weekend, the 8th through the 10th of August. And if you plan to be there Friday evening, be looking for us. WKAR's Current State broadcasting live from 6 to 7 p.m. Friday evening, August 8th from the Great Lakes Folk Festival. That is always a really fun hometown event. Lots to do at the GLFF. Later on this hour, more about a recent snake bite incident here in Michigan that happened down at the Mathai Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor. It's triggered a kind of a caution. I don't want to say a warning. I'm not sure it rises to the level of a warning. I suppose it is. About awareness, you know, being aware that there is a rattlesnake that is native to Michigan, the Eastern Massasauga Rattler. We'll talk with restorative ecologist Stephen Parrish about that and about the Massasauga Rattler and other Michigan snakes here coming up. Our Neighbors in Action segment today, we visit the VFW National Home for Children just down the road in Eaton Rapids. We'll learn more about them. But first, we continue our look at how economic incentives are working here in Michigan. Last week, GM announced plans to expand its Delta Township plant and request a 50% tax break over 12 years from the Lansing City Council. And the new logistics center at GM's Grand River plant that just broke ground comes with a $4 million tax break. Back on Monday, we spoke with Doug Winters, an attorney for Ypsilanti Township, about their cautionary tale of offering incentives to General Motors. The township's experience actually helped tighten Michigan laws that govern economic incentive programs. It turns out that Michigan is one of the nation's leaders in offering incentives to retain companies and attract new ones. At the end of 2012, the New York Times published a database that tracked business incentives awarded by hundreds of municipalities across the country. Besides Texas, no state spends more than Michigan, to the tune of at least $6.6 billion annually. But recent studies have emerged that call into question just how effective these incentive programs are at creating new jobs and attracting economic growth. David Bieri is an assistant professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Michigan. His research has looked at economic incentive programs in the state, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Michigan spends here at least $6.6 billion annually on economic incentive programs, second in the nation. This is according to the New York Times in 2012. That's considerable sum of money. Why so much activity here in Michigan?
Yes, it is indeed. It's about 2% of Michigan GDP. And I think, you know, what economists usually want to know is how much bang are we getting for the buck? And so the most difficult thing about assessing the value of tax incentives as an economic development tool is gauging how much impact do they actually have.
But why so much of this activity in Michigan? Does it have something to do with our manufacturing heritage?
It certainly does. It certainly does. I mean, tax incentives in the United States have long been a policy tool directed at manufacturing. And so given Michigan's large manufacturing heritage, it's perhaps in that sense not surprising that Michigan is number two in the nation as far as the deployment of this tool is concerned. But I think as our discussion develops, I would like to make two specific points as to what might be problematic with this way of conducting public policy.
Very good. I'm sure we will get to that. We want to hear what those are. Let me start out by asking a very general question, though, here. Can you comment as to how effective these tax incentive programs are in general? Is that known?
You know, there is the famous saying amongst economists that there are usually three types of economists, those who can count and those who cannot. And so in that sense, in that sense, the answer is that of the two-handed economist. It's the answer that says, well, on the one hand, there is evidence that they do work, but on the other hand, we're not quite sure how well they do work. The general problem with that type of policy effectiveness question is that, unfortunately, we don't live in a world where we can set up, like our colleagues in the natural sciences, an experiment where we have a parallel world that evolves without the incentive. So, you know, assume we live in the current world where we give the incentives and we have a parallel universe where the incentive isn't given. And then after a certain amount of time, we look at the two worlds and see which one has done better. We can't do this. And so despite tremendous advances in modes of scientific inquiry in applied economics, the jury's still out.
Let's go a little bit deeper as to how municipalities and local governments actually incentivize or try to incentivize economic development. One mm-hmm. way is to offer tax incentives through what's called tax increment financing, TIFs. A lot of people have heard of TIFs. And basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, a TIF is a way for a city to earmark local tax revenue for other specific redevelopment projects. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. And in the state of Michigan, there are a broad set of options that municipalities can deploy that would largely fall under this umbrella of tax increment financing. And that can range from anything from neighborhood redevelopment to infrastructure corridor improvements, all the way to brownfield remediation.
How important are TIFs for Michigan cities?
One would assume that they are, judging from the political discourse. Part of what my research has attempted to do is to quantify how heavily municipalities actually do rely on these instruments relative to the amount of property taxes that are being raised. Unfortunately, it turns out that, this is a question that's not necessarily as straightforward to answer as one might have hoped, due to the complexity, the inherent complexity of these instruments.
So you can't point to a number, for example, you can't point to a dollar figure that captures how much municipalities in Michigan raise in TIFs annually. It's just not that.
I'm afraid so. I can give you a range, what we estimate that this range is, and this range is anywhere between $500 million to about $1.5 billion. Out of roughly, to put this number into perspective, out of roughly $12 billion in property tax revenues raised at the municipal level in the state of Michigan.
Are cities required to report this information to the state?
They are, in principle, required to report this information to the state, but the regulatory compliance with this reporting requirement isn't all that great. As we've discovered over the course of our research.
And why haven't cities been complying with the law? Have you learned anything about that?
Well, I think that, you know, I have a training in the political economy view of the state, and so I think there are certain types of incentives for cities not to report. On the one hand, if they can get away with it at no cost, if the state enforcement mechanism is weak, then you might argue that it's actually rational for them not to report because reporting bears a cost. In the old days, 20, 30 years ago, when revenue sharing in Michigan was much more active, the state could actually withhold shared revenue that it would not disperse to municipalities unless they would comply with that reporting requirement. Now, arguably 30 years ago, the use of those instruments, of tax increment financing instruments in Michigan, was a lot less active. So this is more of a fairly recent phenomenon.
So you have detected a lack of reporting, and that would suggest that the state is not keeping track of the money that cities set aside for development?
The state is trying to. I think what my research has indicated is it's not for a lack of effort, but I think to some extent the resources are lacking at the state level, and in general, the I guess the different levels of state and local government have grown to such a complexity that what seems on the surface, using common sense, a fairly straightforward reporting job is in technicality a fairly difficult matter. And so, yes, the answer is, unfortunately, reporting is not as high as it ought to be, surprisingly.
Our guest on Current State is David Bieri, Assistant Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Michigan. David's research has looked into economic incentive programs in Michigan, and we are talking about that. How often does a TIF go wrong? Have you learned anything about that?
Well, I mean, as always, it's in a sense, as Warren Buffett said, of all sorts of financial instruments, they're not intrinsically weapons of mass financial destruction, but they can be. And so one concern is, of course, that if not deployed appropriately or without the appropriate safeguards, they can wreak havoc. And we do have anecdotal evidence of where these instruments have committed communities in ways that have made their fiscal matters worse rather than better. Remembering that these instruments are, in a sense, an instrument of financial emergency. They arose in the 1950s in California to allow communities to match local redevelopment dollars to federal dollars. And so these instruments were not intended to be used on a day-to-day basis, yet communities, particularly in Michigan, have come to rely on them for local economic development purposes.
To back up just a little bit, to get back to the issue of reporting this money to the state, why should we care that the state cannot keep track or isn't keeping track of the money that cities set aside for development?
Well, I think it goes into this the question that you asked earlier about us, the public, being able to say how effective are the affairs of public intervention. You know, how effective are these public policy initiatives? And so reporting is the most obvious way in which we ensure public accountability at several levels of government. I mean, one of the beauties of living in a democracy is that we have the ability to tax ourselves. But informs us of what it does with the money. And so reporting plays an important part of that public accountability process.
If a TIF goes wrong, though, or if a TIF goes bad, who's on the hook?
As we've painfully learned, that the answer to all of to that question invariably post crisis is the taxpayer. Through one way or different taxpayers or different constituencies will have to bail out these TIFs gone bad.
Like, just to look at the other side of the coin here, do you have any evidence as to how often TIFs accomplish what they set out to accomplish? We're hearing cautionary tales about how often they don't work. What have you learned about how often they do work?
They are definitely a valuable tool in the armory of local government. Let's also not forget that local governments have had fiscally a very tough time over the last 20 years, essentially fighting all sorts of pushbacks on possible tax increases, while demands on local governments have increased. And so TIFs definitely have a role to play. And in a number of instances, when they're with the appropriate safeguards are put in place, can work out well. The worry is if governments exclusively begin to rely on TIFs, for the reasons that I outlined earlier, which is that we currently don't have the regulatory environment in Michigan in place that even allows us to engage in a rational political debate about the pros and cons.
Well, that creates even more pressure on local governments, it would appear. How might local governments better deal with this situation and protect themselves in a situation like this?
I think we're seeing efforts at various levels of local government organization, the Michigan Municipal League, the Downtown Authorities Association. People are getting together. Everybody's realizing that to throw out the baby with the bathwater in you know, the worst possible outcome of a broader discussion about TIF reform or tax increments finance regulation in the state would be to abolish it, to deny municipalities that aspect. And I think the sort of the bottom-up approach where municipalities are beginning to realize that if this instrument is taken away from them and the state has all the statutory rights to do that, then they're at a loss. And so good governance essentially serves the very constituencies who rely on that instrument. And so there is some bottom-up, I guess, reform movements. But personally, I think that's not enough. There is a stronger top-down imposition from the state that's required to make sure that we have these, say, key performance indicators on the fiscal affairs related to tax increment financing in Michigan.
In discussions like this, you occasionally hear of clawback provisions. What are clawback provisions, and what relevance do they have?
Clawback provisions are relevant. Without being too technical, I think they're a way of ensuring that all constituencies get their fair share of the deal. And I think clawback provisions are relevant as a general category for tax incentives, and they best need to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. I think part of the concern that I have for tax-based incentives at the local level is that they set up, and I don't want to get too much ahead of myself here, but they set up a very asymmetric relationship between the ultimate beneficiary of the provision. And as we've heard on your show, this would be General Motors in the case of a specific locality versus the locality itself. No, in principle, clawback provisions in any contract are sensible. But what resources does Delta Township in Lansing have, does Ypsilanti have, when it comes to enforcing those clawback provisions vis-a-vis a much more sophisticated corporations such as GM or Chrysler or Ford.
David, any thoughts on why there aren't more efforts on the part of the public to track results and hold companies accountable?
I think because it's an intrinsically complex and fragmented fiscal system that the U.S. has developed over the last 80 years. And where does institutional reform begin? You know, one of the complexities, for instance, for tax incentives arises with the very fact that the incentives that are given to manufacturing firms in Michigan, these are incentives that are state incentives that overlaid with county incentives that are overlaid with municipal incentives. These are not only incentives across different governments, but there are also incentives across different types of instruments. So these are sales tax incentives, property tax abatement incentives, corporate income tax incentives. And to get a unified, simple view on this is intrinsically complex. Maybe I can just...
What should happen next? What do you think should happen next?
I think deal to happen next is for this discussion to be continued in Lansing, and I know of such efforts already in the previous legislative period, and that these efforts go in the direction of more disclosure, which would then allow us to have more accountability and ultimately more transparency on what works in local economic development versus what doesn't. So it doesn't become this opaque, alchemistic tool that some people, for political reasons, love versus others who hate it, so that we can have a rational debate. And that can only happen through the strong hand in Lansing with the collaboration of communities.
Alchemistic. Very interesting choice of words there. David Bieri is an assistant professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Michigan. David, thank you for joining us.
It was wonderful being on the show. Thank you.
And next Monday, we continue our look at economic incentive programs. We'll talk with the Lansing Economic Area Partnership about how we measure the success of our incentive programs here in the Lansing area. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The passions of farming, cooking, brewing, and much more are all a part of Road Belly magazine. The Grand Rapids-based publication is about to enter its second year as it expands its scope beyond Western Michigan. Road Belly is an ad-free magazine and website devoted to covering what's new and growing in Michigan food and beverage. WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with Road Belly magazine partner Matt Drolet by phone yesterday. Matt started off by discussing Road Belly's roots.
I think that really what happened was, if you trace it back to the economy and how the economy dipped, and suddenly people were starting to realize that they had to tighten their belts, and so being able to go to Chicago for the weekend and do things like that, they weren't in the plan. And I think that the market reacted to that, where you started to have all these really talented, really, we call them artisans. They're chefs, they're distillers, they're brewers. Say, you know, we really, if you look at the state of Michigan, we really have all the best raw materials to do to create the best product and do the best services here. So you've got the farms, you've got you've got hop farms up in Leelanau County. You've got what they call the salad bowl down near Hudsonville, Michigan. You got all these things that came together, and then you had this great talent that also put all those things to use.
Tell me about the writers and photographers, the presenting talent behind the food and beverage talent. How did you gather your team?
The core group that we have is a really talented group of creatives, of writers and photographers, and we always are looking for somebody that has a little bit of an edge, a little, not necessarily an angry side, but something stewing inside of them that they really want to get out, and that is something that really is unique to our magazine.
Right. Hey, something that I thought was pretty unique, you have on your homepage some beautiful images that relate to the photography that are in the magazine. And the video begins with what looks like to me about a 1977 Lincoln Continental with some Longhorns sort of lashed to the hood. What's that all about? I was just curious.
You know, there's a gentleman in the west part of the state that car belongs to him, and we had to go back at him two or three times to beg him to use the car in the video, and finally he relented, and because it fit what we were looking for. It fit that style. You know, you had a Michigan car in there, and it's about hitting the road in the old fashioned, you know, in the old fashioned sense. I mean, I grew up in the 70s, where we used to hit the road in my dad's Oldsmobile and drive. You know, you weren't going up north until you were driving at least 3 hours north.
So ride with us. Travel with your mouth, your feet, in your mind, and in your heart. Road Belly. Go with your gut.
That kind of harkened back to that, but it was just it's just really cool imagery, and you'll be seeing it again.
I'm glad to know that, because it was a really cool car with sort of an edgy surprise to it. I loved the Longhorns.
Yeah, that's great.
Talk about the digital and the print personalities of Road Belly.
As a matter of fact, we have discontinued the digital end of it with regards to the full content.
Okay.
And the reason we did that, interestingly enough, is we did some market studies. And the market studies, during those market studies, we found that our younger readers, those readers that were 19 to about 27 years old, by far preferred the print edition.
Really?
They liked the look. They liked the They liked the look, the feel, the smell of it. It's so one of the funniest things is every time I go talk to somebody about Road Belly and I show them a copy of Road Belly, the first thing they do is smell it. It's the weirdest thing.
I'm doing that right now.
Okay, see, there you go. There you go. Proof. The proof is in the pudding. So, but one of the things that they said to us was they said that we prefer the print edition vastly over the digital copy because everything to this point in our lives, being the, you know, the 19 to 27, everything is digital. Everything is transient. Everything's disposable. There's nothing permanent in our lives right now. And we like the permanence of Road Belly. And some of the comments that we read were people saying that this is the kind of magazine that you sit back in an easy chair and you can read it front to back because what you've got is you've got pure content. You've got great photography. You've got great writing. And you've got no ads in the magazine. And so there's nothing to break up that flow of just sitting and reading. And people appreciate that.
Yeah, Matt, what is the smell of the magazine? It's almost, to me, sort of a like an earthy, kind of like a clay smell.
I think it's just Michigan magic. I don't know what the smell, I have no idea what the smell. We don't put the smell in there. That's just how it comes from the printer.
There you go. This is Peter Warf for Current State on WKAR. I'm talking with Matt Drolet, one of the partners for Road Belly Magazine, the Grand Rapids-based food and beverage magazine that is starting to cover all of Michigan. Talk about some of your favorite stories. There have been some issues now. You must have some favorites or some that stand out to you.
Yeah, there really are a few favorites. You know, one of the things that we really pride ourselves on doing that you don't find in other magazines is that we like to get to the story behind the story. Because we really believe that every establishment that's opened is open because of a passion that somebody has. Because they're artisans, and so everything that they do is an extension of their heart and soul. And so we really try to tell that story because we think that's the more compelling story. So some of the places that will, one of the places that has been such a pleasant surprise is this place up in Atlanta, Michigan. Atlanta is between Alpena and Petoskey, or it's between Alpena and Gaylord, right on that little road. And I forget what it's, I think it's M42, something like that. And you drive through Atlanta, Michigan, and you see the normal things that you would see in a small town like Atlanta. You see a gas station, you see an outdoor outfitter, you see something with a moose on it, and then you run across this baklava shop that sticks out like a sore thumb. And I went in there the first time last year, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and met the Prince family. And it's Georgette Prince and her daughters and her whole family run this little baklava place that's just a gem. And they make amazing baklava, but their story is Georgette was, and there's a lot of these stories out there, Georgette was one of these women that would make baklava for her family. Then suddenly her family and friends wanted it. Then she would go to a party and they would always ask, hey, Georgette, are you bringing the baklava? And so it turned into this shop, and it's just one of those little gems that is actually a source of pride for us that we find those types of places in Michigan.
Matt, there, as you mentioned, there are no ads in the magazine. So what is your financial model?
One of the things we found was that from a standpoint of cost, a lot of these magazines that exist out there are really prohibitive to the little guy. And so for someone to spend their hard-earned money on advertising, quote-unquote, they would have to, you know, it would be such an exorbitant cost that either they'd have to settle for such a small ad, which is a business card size ad that, you know, talks about, gives their logo, tells their location, and that's about it. Or they can look at a company like us or look at a publication like ours, where for about that same cost, we can help them out and we can tell the story. It's allowing the reader to connect to them. Everybody has a place that they like to go wherever they live, that they feel like they go there because they know the person that owns it. They know the backstory. And that is going to create a loyalty more so than what kind of club sandwich you've got. And that really is what makes Road Belly so unique. And it allows the little guy to get, you know, a two-page layout and really tell their story and make that connection with the readers. And hopefully what that'll do is that'll, you know, create more customers and more friends to come through the door and give them a try.
Matt Drolet is one of the partners for Road Belly Magazine, the Grand Rapids-based food and beverage publication covering Michigan. Matt, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you very much. And if you'd like to find out about getting a copy of Road Belly, you can go to roadbelly.com or you can visit our Facebook page.
Great. Thanks for that. For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Gannett, Michigan's Paul Egan reports today that Richard Bernstein, the Michigan attorney with who's an associate partner in the Sam Bernstein Law Firm in Farmington Hills, will announce his candidacy for the Michigan Supreme Court today. Richard Bernstein will be seeking a Democratic nomination, according to the story. This November, voters will decide two full terms and one partial term for the state's highest court. Richard Bernstein announcing his candidacy today for the Michigan Supreme Court. Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Being Wednesday, it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature the VFW National Home for Children. The campus, located in Eaton Rapids, offers a nationwide helpline and has 43 single-family homes for families of active-duty military or veterans from around the country. Here to tell us more about the VFW National Home for Children, Angela Gambrell, who is the Public Relations Officer. Hi, Angela.
Good morning.
And joining us also, Kirsten Grady, a case manager who works with the families. Welcome, Kirsten.
Nice to be here.
The VFW National Home for Children has a long history in mid-Michigan. We were talking about it during the break. Angela, share a little bit more of that with us.
Okay. Well, the National Home was born out of a desire to honor those who served our country by helping their families. And what the early founders dreamed of was an entire village that would help the families of our veteran and military. And so we were founded in 1925. We received our first family, a lady named Mrs. Annie Pollitt, and six children moved into the VFW National Home for Children. And therefore, in January, we'll mark 90 years of serving veteran and military families.
Was that a World War One family then?
Yes, it was.
I take it, in 1925?
Yes, her husband was a World War One veteran. At the time, they called it the Great War, of course.
Yeah.
And he was killed in a car accident, ironically going to cash his military pension check. Hmm. Well, at that time, there was no provisions made for widows. And so she was going to be left destitute with six children. And the home was starting to be up and running. Someone had donated some acreage near Eaton Rapids, Michigan, for the National Home. And so they were brought in as the first family instead of becoming destitute, which happened to many widows of World War I veterans.
How big is your campus today?
Our campus is 629 acres total, and 70 acres makes up the campus community that includes 42 single-family homes.
42,
and,
okay.
Yes. And we also have a licensed child care center, a community center, and other recreational opportunities for the families who live at the home.
Kirsten, you're a case manager there. Tell us about the people that you're serving here in 2014.
Well, right now, most of our families are single-parent families, although we now have more and more married families with children that are coming onto our campus. Mm. We do have a good population of veterans on our campus, as well as people who have a family member who was a veteran, and that makes their eligibility for coming onto our campus.
Are we talking widows or single people from couples who have lost their lives in conflicts in Afghanistan or where?
Sometimes sometimes. Sometimes it's just somebody who's maybe gotten a divorce. Maybe they are not they're not directly connected to a veteran, meaning they're not married to a veteran. Maybe their veteran is their father who fought in Vietnam. Or maybe their veteran is their grandfather who fought in Korea.
Hmm. Okay.
So it's really just as long as they have a veteran who is VFW eligible, they can come onto our campus.
That's the main requirement. Are there any other requirements?
Well, we have three different requirements. Either someone who is the descendant of a VFW member or a member of its ladies' auxiliary, an active duty military, or a veteran. So that's the three different types of qualifications that we have to stay in the home. But that's only the start of that.
We are talking today about the VFW National Home for Children in Eaton Rapids, Michigan, just down the road from us here in Lansing, in East Lansing. Been there since 1925. Kirsten, what are some of the issues that the families that come to your program often are struggling with?
The number one issue that people are struggling with are financial issues. Either they have amassed a large amount of debt and feel like they're drowning in debt, or sometimes they were never able to go to college. I've got a resident that I've worked with that she had a child very early in life, and so she never went to college. Her first college experience came when she came onto the National Home campus.
Mm. How do you work with them exactly?
Well, I work to help them set goals. So a lot of them already have some idea of what they want to do when they come on campus. But I work with them to help them create specific goals as to what they want to achieve before they leave our campus.
We're talking financial goals, since most of these people come to you with financial issues.
Yeah, financial goals, maybe an employment goal. We do education-type goals, parenting goals. Some people need some extra parenting support, wellness goals. Some people come a little broken, and so they need that psychiatric or psychologist to help them sort through their issues, and maybe they never even had the chance to do that until they came to our campus.
Angela, do the kids attend local public schools, or do you have your own school?
No. In the past, things were different, but right now the children either attend Eaton Rapids schools, or because we do have school of choice in Michigan, some of them have been attending the Leslie schools, which is a little community nearby Eaton Rapids, but the majority do go to Eaton Rapids public schools, and they're picked up right within the community.
And how long can families stay with you?
Well, they can stay with us up to 4 years, and one of the things I want to stress is that when I said that the qualifications were just the first step, and Kirsten also touched on that, is that the families, the parents have to be willing to work through certain goals to live there. They don't just live there for up to 4 years and don't do anything. I mean, it's a goal-oriented program. I want to stress that for people.
Okay.
And one of the first steps of becoming, resident of the VFW National Home for Children is calling our Military and Veteran Family Helpline, and that's 800-313-4200. And that's staffed by people, 8 to 4:30, who will work with the caller to either help them become, a resident, a client of the VFW National Home for Children, or help them within their own communities.
That's
so it's
typically
like twofold.
That's typically the first step, though, is
yes.
A call to the 800 number.
Definitely.
Okay, now the opportunity to live in a single family home while you work, while you're getting back on your feet, is pretty rare. Do you have a waiting list now?
No, we don't have a waiting list. We try to, stress that, families are always coming and going within the VFW National Home. And so we have it set that when people do need it, they are able to get in. But it's not a crisis program. It's not like, okay, you get in tomorrow. You go through a long process of being admitted to the VFW National Home for Children. So it could take a month or more to get in.
Where does your funding come from?
Well, we receive no government funding. I want to stress that. And that all of our funding is from donations, from people like private donations, people in VFW posts nationwide, people in ladies' auxiliary posts nationwide. We're solely run by donations, and we have been
That's kind of interesting, though, because it would seem the federal government would have a vested interest in what you do. Has that ever been explored, or does the law prevent that?
Well, we prefer to keep it separate from the federal government, and that way we can, you know, mold it how we need to for
okay.
our clients.
I gotcha. Kirsten, is there a story that comes to mind that encapsulates why you do what you do?
Sure. There are so many, but the one that comes to my mind right now is a young mother. She was in her early 20s, and she came onto our campus very much had never lived independently before. She either lived with somebody or lived with her parents. During our campus, she learned a lot about her financial goals. She learned about how to balance her finances, how to make a budget. She learned how to parent more effectively. By the time that she left our program, she bought her own house. She bought her very first house, and she's now living there very happily with her child.
Wow, impressive. Angela, is there one for you?
Well, for me, it is helping veteran and military families, because in the past, I used to be a military reporter, and so I wrote a lot about people who were coming back from Afghanistan and the things that they went through. And when I decided to do something different, I wanted to do something that would help military and veteran families, because they have given so much to our country, and I wanted to be able to give back.
Who'd you report for? That's very interesting.
Midland Daily News in Midland,
okay.
Michigan.
Okay, yeah. And you basically focused on people coming back from...
Right, right.
Okay. Very interesting. Are there opportunities to volunteer, Angela?
Well, we do have opportunities to volunteer. I would encourage people to call our general line if they want to talk more about that, and that's 1-800-424-8360. And, you know, there's different things. We have, like, one example that comes to mind, we had a group from Kentucky come up, a group of veterans, and they wanted to help out at the National Home, and they came up and helped build a deck on our scout by our scout cabin. We have a scout cabin way back in like our woodsy area, you know.
You more. Have a lot of acreage.
Yes,
you
we
said
do.
600 some acres.
629. Yes.
This is a lot of space where the young folks who are living there can
right.
really explore. I take
right.
it.
Right. Well, some of it is farmland that we lease out to farmers in the area. But a lot of it is camping areas. You know, the scout cabin that I just mentioned, and going back to the volunteer opportunities, they came up and built a deck for the cabin so people could go out onto the deck and look out at the water. There's a lake. It's a man-made lake, but it's a small lake. But people do fish off the deck. So that's one volunteer opportunity that a group took part in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, being the national home, though, it's easy to assume that a facility in Eaton Rapids with 42 living units is overwhelmed with requests.
Right. Well, one of my jobs, what I'm trying to do is to make people more aware about the National Home for Children, because there's kind of a saying in the VFW that we're the best kept secret of the VFW, and we don't want to be the best kept secret. We want people to call us and utilize our services either on campus or in their communities, because our helpline also helps people within the communities. If they can't or don't want to move to Eaton Rapids, we help them hook up with services within their own community.
Very interesting, yeah.
And we want people to call us. We want more people to be there. And we know that with people coming back from Afghanistan and families needing help with reintegration, that we're going to have more people if we get the word out.
And remind us of that national helpline number. That's the starting point for an awful lot of people.
And that is 1-800-313-4200.
Very good. You got a website too, I presume.
Yes, we do. And our website is www.vfwnationalhome.org.
You know, you have one of those, you have a home there that I think an awful lot of people in the Lansing area know about. They've driven by it, what have you. But it's interesting to find out more about what you do. We thank you for joining us today.
Well,
Angela Gambrell is the Public Relations Officer for the VFW National Home for Children in Eaton Rapids. And Kirsten Grady is a case manager who works with families there. Thanks again.
Well, thank you for having us.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work, but we just don't know about them. Please help us out. Tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We reported yesterday on a recent snake bite incident here in Lower Michigan. A young barefoot visitor to an Ann Arbor botanical garden was bitten by an eastern Massasauga rattlesnake, the only rattlesnake native to our state. The 12-year-old was hospitalized and she recovered. The incident has triggered an advisory from a group of Michigan naturalists of the risk of an encounter with this species of snake in our state. And to learn more, we welcome Stephen Parrish, a restorative ecologist at the Mathai Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor, where this encounter happened. Welcome, Stephen.
Hello, good to be here.
I understand you manage the area where this snake bite occurred.
That's true. Yeah, there's 250 acres that we oversee here, and it's prime habitat for the eastern Massasauga rattlesnake. It's been here for thousands of years, and it likes wetland habitat, so Fleming Creek runs right through the middle of the property, and we have a couple of creeks or ponds, and they also need a kind of an adjacent upland for feeding grounds in the summertime.
Okay. You're saying that the eastern Massasauga has been there as long as anybody can remember?
Yeah. Yes. It's been here throughout the Lower Peninsula, really ever since the last ice age retreated, and the Massasauga migrated north and takes residence in many parts of the Lower Peninsula. Their numbers have been dwindling considerably over the last 100 years. For a variety of reasons.
You've got a lot of acreage down there where a lot of snakes could call home. Do you know how many you have?
Well, there was a recent study in 2010 and 2011 where some researchers came out and tried to do a field survey of the snake, and they found 27 individuals that were recorded. They didn't do every square inch of the property, so there could be more, there could be less. About once a year, we see one that gets run over. There's accidents in the field where vehicles run over them. So, like anything in nature, they breed and they are born every fall, and then so the populations ebb and flow. But we have a pretty stable population here.
How often will an encounter with an eastern Massasauga rattlesnake result in a bite?
Well, it depends on how close you are. They're very timid creatures. They're small and they're slow. Sometimes you can see them basking on the trails or even on the road. And if you just keep your distance, they will mind your distance. Most of the time, any problem occurs is if somebody tries to play Steve Irwin and wants to try to pick the snake up.
Yeah.
And that's when some bites can occur. And it's something that can happen in nature.
Was this the first snake bite incident you've had down there? Or have there been others?
It's the first snake bite since I've been here in the last 3 years.
What happened exactly?
You know, I wasn't even here. I was on leave for 2 weeks. My wife gave birth, and so I wasn't even here. But
the reports indicated the girl that was bitten was walking barefoot, which I suppose doesn't get the good housekeeping seal of approval when there are rattlesnakes nearby.
Right. Proper footwear, yeah. Most people, if they do get bit, is going to be, since it's such a small snake, it doesn't have a great range. It's usually people wearing sandals or wearing no shoes at all. That's something that if you are concerned about rattlesnake bites, then proper footwear, hiking boots, long pants. Otherwise, you can just really kind of pay attention to your surroundings.
How dangerous can the bite of an eastern Massasauga be?
Rarely fatal. It's been over 50 years since I've seen any kind of recording of anyone even dying from them. But it's interesting. 25 to 50% of the time that they do strike, and they strike out of protection of themselves when they feel threatened. They don't attack anyone.
And you and other naturalists are taking pains to just remind people that this snake does live in Michigan, and there are the chances of an encounter with one.
Yes, we have signage throughout the property, and at the front lobby we have a stuffed Massasauga, so visitors can know what to look for when they are out on the trails. But it is it is rarely life-threatening, and sometimes the bites aren't even envenomated. It's kind of a warning strike if they feel threatened.
Stephen Parrish is a restorative ecologist at the Mathai Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor. We've been talking about Michigan's only rattlesnake, the eastern Massasauga. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll be joined by the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta to have our political month in review. Jonathan Osting of MLive and Susan Demos of Inside Michigan Politics joins in as well. And we'll take a look at the current charter school discussion as well, and the Detroit water shutoff, other Michigan topics. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, also to Aaron Young for engineering, and to Marie Steinbach for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.